3:7. Temple marriage, when joining a couple, divides a family, with panelists Margaret Toscano and Vicki Stewart.
Welcome to session 337 of the Sunstone Symposium. We're very glad that you decided to attend this session. I know there were a lot of difficult choices. The title of our presentation today is Temple Marriage, When Joining a Couple Divides a Family. This session is sponsored by the Mormon Women's Forum. If you haven't already, I encourage you to visit our table in the multipurpose room where we have both the current issue of the Mormon Women's Forum quarterly and also past issues for sale. Also, we have some copies of Mother Wove the Morning and also t-shirts, all of which Carolyn Pearson has donated to the forum to try to help us raise money, which we desperately need. So I would encourage you to do that. Also, if you're not familiar with the forum, talk to me, Janice Allred, raise your hand, someone else who is part of the Mormon Women's Forum, and we'd love to tell you more about it. Also, the Mormon Women's Forum sponsors a yearly conference. Our one this year will be October 24th at the Utah Valley State College. These yearly conferences are a one-day conference. We start in the morning around 8 and we go until about 6 in the evening. The ones that we've had in the past have been wonderful, lots of panel discussions, presenters, really good discussions. We need people to give papers, to be parts of, participate on panels. If you have any interest, we'd love to have you fill out a form or just give your name to one of us and we'll get back in touch with you. Let me start our panel by introducing our panelists. I'm glad that you made it, Maxine. We were a little bit nervous, but thinking, oh, well, we'll have more time for audience participation, right? I am the moderator of the panel. My name is Margaret Toscano. I have been on the board of the Mormon Women's Forum since it started in, was it 1988 or 89? It was 89. No, it was 88, actually. It started in the fall of 88, and I've been on the board ever since then. I also have a master's degree in classical languages. I've been working on my PhD forever. I may eventually finish it. I'm writing my dissertation. It's in comparative literature and languages at the University of Utah. And I'm also the co-author of Strangers in Paradox with my husband, and we are the parents of four daughters. To my left is Vicki Stewart. And where did I put your introduction, Vicki? I know a lot about you anyway. Vicki Stewart has taught gospel doctrine class in her Salt Lake ward for the last 3 years. I was the gospel doctrine teacher before Vicki. It was a great ward.
She's a hard act to follow.
She's a graduate of Stanford University, and she currently works as an executive recruiter. Vicki is a single mother with four children, including one son who's on a mission in Romania and another one who served a mission in Costa Rica. Nadine Hansen, who's on my far left, is an attorney and has been for many years. She does general practice. She recently moved to Cedar City from California, so that should be an interesting change. Nadine has participated in Sunstone for a number of years. She's given lots of papers and participated on panels. She's also written and published in Dialogue and other Mormon periodicals, including our own Mormon Women's Forum Quarterly. We're always looking for contributors. So she's been a very important feminist voice in the community, and we're very happy to have her too. And finally, Maxine Hanks is on my right. Maxine, I didn't get a lot of information on you, so I'll just say what I know. Maxine, you are still a freelance editor and writer. She edited the very important Women in Authority, which was a collection of feminist voices She also has given a lot of presentations in Sunstone, has done a lot for the Mormon Women's Forum. She has a new book that came out. What is the title of that, Maxine?
We're doing a book signing right after this session. It's Getting Together with Yesterday, a tour of San Pete County Historic Buildings.
Very interesting. Anyway, if you're interested in history or art, that's a great book to look at. So that's our panel. What we're going to do is each of these three will present a statement. Then we're going to discuss some questions. And then we're going to open it up to the audience, and we hope we can have a lot of interaction. Mostly what we want to do is have interaction, this panel. The idea for this paper, even though, or for this panel, even though we've only been discussing it for the last few months, really the idea began years ago, although none of us thought of it in those terms at the time. Imagine, it's your wedding day. What in fantasy is supposed to be one of the happiest celebrations of your life. But in reality, we know it is likely to be full of untold stress. There are so many details to worry about. The reception, the pictures, the honeymoon, making yourself look beautiful, not to mention those last-minute jitters. You're wondering if you're doing the right thing. Eternity is a very long time, after all. And on top of all of this, when you get to the temple, some of your dearest friends and relatives are not able to be with you at that pinnacle moment. Maybe it's your mother or your father, your grandparents, your closest friend, your siblings, a favorite aunt or uncle. There's always someone who has to wait outside the temple. Not even the most active family, I think, in the church escapes this reality. So the question that we want to explore today is this. Is it right in a church that claims to be the most pro-family organization in the world to create this division among family members? Ironically, ceilings are about connecting people and creating emotional and spiritual bonds. Does the policy of the church promote or interfere with this goal? Now, I think it's probably important for me to state right now that we don't mean this session to just be a negative church bashing thing. I think all of us here, I don't know if I can speak for everybody, are supportive of ceilings in theory. We are not against temple marriage, so I don't want anybody to misinterpret us with that. Our goal in this panel is to perhaps explore some possibilities for change, looking for positive alternatives, at the same time keeping in place the Mormon traditions that are so dear to people in the church. Are there other alternatives? Are there things that maybe we could do differently? So we're hoping that that is what is going to happen. Now, in spite of the fact that we don't want this to be this completely negative church bashing, I also firmly believe that whenever there are problems, that one of the ways of working through problems in a positive way is that we have to speak our pain. And I know that a lot of people have suffered because of some of these things. In fact, I bet that everybody in this room has a story. And I think one of the purposes of this session is to share those stories. I have a story. I've been married twice. The first time was not in the temple. And so, of course, my memory of that marriage is a lot of the shame and guilt that I felt because I was not being married in the temple. Basically, it couldn't be a happy celebration because I was disappointing my parents and I was doing the bad thing. So there's another whole other aspect of it. The kinds of feelings that we make people feel who, for one reason or another, do not marry in the temple. In fact, my memory of that is that it didn't really feel like a marriage at all. It was kind of a mournful sort of experience. My second marriage to Paul was in the temple. And I guess because of my first experience, how I had felt I had disappointed my parents so much, I was very relieved and happy to be married in the temple. Also, I'd had my own endowments for some years and very much enjoyed attending the temple. And because I was in love with Paul, I was very happy to be sealed to him. So I felt very happy about that. On the other hand, Paul's family, most of his family are non-members, were and still are. Neither of his parents were members of the church. And so, of course, his parents had to sit outside the temple while my parents were inside. As I look back on it now, I don't think I was sympathetic enough to them. I think I was so involved in my own feelings of joy of being in the temple that I didn't really understand how much this hurt them. One of the results that I see of it, of this experience, was that Paul's mother, even though real anxious to join the church before that, certainly wouldn't have after this experience. Her response was, "What kind of a church is this that won't let parents see their own children married?" Looking back on it now, I wonder, you know, was there something else that we could have done? And so that is really what we want to explore today. Okay, so our format, we're going to start with Vicki. We will then go to who's going to outline for us some of the contemporary policy of the church on this issue. We will then go to Nadine, who's going to talk about some of the practical matters and what happens in families. Next, we're going to go to Maxine, who is going to deal with some of the theological historical issues and also give some of her own experiences. We'll finally go back to Vicki, who will tell her experience, and then I want to ask them a few questions, and then we'll open it up to the audience.
You can sit. I'm going to sit. Thank you. I think we need to make it clear at the beginning of this panel that we are talking about a particular type of temple sealing, and that is a temple sealing that it simultaneously is requiring a marriage license. There are lots of sealings that go on in the temple that are not in the purview of this panel, but those that require a marriage license and therefore are a first-time combination marriage sealing are the ones that we're talking about here. My role in this right now, is this on? Have I done something dreadful?
You're sounding good.
Okay.
I think this is just the tape.
Hold on, we are just going to reconnect some wires here. My role here at the beginning of this is to present the church's position on temple marriages, and that's how I'm going to refer to them. A sealing that requires a marriage license, I'm going to call a temple marriage. The Orthodox position on the subject of temple marriages was most recently presented in a two-part article appearing in the June and July issues of the Ensign magazine. The statement was in the form of two letters from a member of the Council of 70, Creel Coford, to a young couple named Kirsten and Tom, who are planning to be married in the temple and have a number of questions. Elder Coford first explains the differences between a temple marriage and a civil marriage. This is a quote. "A civil marriage is powerless to do anything but qualify the man and the woman to live together under the laws of the land. Adorning the ceremony with a minister or even an LDS bishop, a beautiful church or other building, tuxedos, limousines, music, and all of the other trappings will not change that. An empty box is not given substance by the most beautiful gift wrapping. So it is with a civil marriage. It's not the Lord's way, and no amount of rationalizing will ever change that unchangeable fact." In the second letter, which was part of the second article, Elder Coford gives a list of reasons why couples should marry in the temple. Because the Lord said so, because being sealed in the temple is the only way you can begin to qualify to have your marriage continue forever and have your family join together in a family organization forever, because there are special blessings that flow from obedience to covenants, because it tells you a lot about the person you will be marrying, and because it serves as a great self-assessment for you as to your individual worthiness and commitment. Next comes some advice on how to schedule the events of the day. Quote, "Plan the activities of the temple day such that they focus on the spiritual.
I realize this is extremely hard to do when you're talking about being sealed. There are many times when people come from out of town who want to express their best wishes. Sometimes there is a meal. Usually there's a reception. All too often, you are so exhausted you are unable to comprehend the significance of what you have experienced. Frequently, you become so caught up in the things of the world that it becomes difficult, if not impossible, to fully appreciate the things of God. Realizing that sometimes it simply can't be done, do everything you can to move as many social commitments off that day as possible. Often we cheat ourselves out of the greatest spiritual experiences of our lifetime by being too wrapped up in temporal things. Remember that your wedding day is not a social experience with a tinge of the spiritual, but is rather a spiritual experience with a tinge of the social. Finally, Elder Coford discusses the issue of dealing with friends and relatives who do not have a recommend. Significantly, he classifies all of them as non-member parents or relatives, making no acknowledgement of the heartbreaking fact that the temple also excludes members of the church who do not hold recommends and siblings who are too young to have received their endowments. Elder Coford first cites D&C 109, verse 20, "No unclean thing shall be permitted to come into thy house to pollute it," adding that this and similar verses place a commandment upon those who are administratively responsible to safeguard the temples that no unclean thing should enter. He then offers the following advice on how to deal with those who cannot attend the sealing. He says, "One of the greatest emotional pressures on brides or grooms is when parents or other close relatives are not members of the church. They generally don't understand what's going on, nor do they have any appreciation for it. In the case of parents, their whole lives have been lived in anticipation of the time when they would see their son or daughter married in the only kind of marriage with which they have any familiarity. So when you announce to them that you are going to the temple and they cannot attend, they naturally feel a great loss and a great exclusion. What do you do? How do you handle it? Here are a few ideas that might help. 1. First, be very understanding of their feelings, and as much as possible help them comprehend what's going to occur and why they can't be with you. 2. Even as you do that, however, I would not do it in a tone of apology. You need not be apologetic about God's ways. 3. Try to make them feel as much a part of what's going on that day as you can. Invite them to come to the temple and arrange for someone to be with them while you are in the temple. It's possible they might like to go through the visitor center or do any number of other activities available, including just enjoying the beautiful grounds that surround the temple. As you leave the temple for pictures and other activities, you can rejoin your relatives and involve them in all that's going on. 4. You may want to arrange with your bishop to hold a meeting for those who don't have temple recommends. This meeting should include prayer, music, and remarks by a priesthood holder, but should not include a ceremony or the exchange of vows. Over the years, I've seen such activities a number of times, and when they are handled properly, I have never yet seen a non-member or less active member take offense. If they know how much this temple ordinance means to you, they will give you the support you desire. 5. The Brethren counsel church members not to perform a marriage ceremony following a temple sealing. Occasionally, you'll find a young couple who will want to do a mock ceremony, quote, "so my mother won't feel left out." But that makes a mockery out of your temple sealing. It will impact all that happens to you in the temple. You will not enjoy the same level of spiritual involvement and spiritual enlightenment you would otherwise have received. You will find that you will not satisfy those who are not able to attend the temple ceremony. Your bishop will be happy to discuss those kinds of activities, which would be appropriate following the temple sealing. The article contains a good deal more information than I have recounted, and it ends with a short section on policies for adapting bridal gowns for temple sealings.
I have two married children, and both of them married people who were converts to the church and whose families were not members of the church. So what I'm going to do is tell you about what we did, or I really should say what they did, because it was their plans, not ours as parents, to include the members of the other family. My first child to get married was my son. His fiance at the time had joined the church just 2 months earlier, and they could not go to the temple because she had not been a member of the church long enough. when they initially decided to get married, it was on Memorial Day weekend. That was when they got engaged. And they talked about when they were going to get married, and they wanted to get married in the temple. So they had talked with their bishop, and the bishop told them that if they got married outside of the temple, they would have to wait a year before they could be sealed in the temple. It turned out that that was not accurate, and that according to the General Handbook of Instructions, if the reason for not getting married in the temple is that one of the partners hasn't been a member of the church long enough, then they can go to the temple on the first anniversary of the convert spouse's baptism. So they would not have had to wait a full year if they got married outside the temple, but obviously they couldn't be sealed unless they waited another 10 months before they got married. They initially decided that they would wait actually over a year until the following June to get married in order to accommodate people's schedules. We didn't think that was a real good idea for them to wait that long, and we suggested to them that they just go ahead and get married and then go and be sealed later, even if they had to wait a year for the sealing. So they decided that they would, not just because of what we said, but for a variety of reasons, they decided that they would get married in September. So we began planning a wedding, and their bishop was going to marry them. They were going to be married in the courtyard of one of the local LDS chapels. This was in California. And we were planning the wedding, and one night I went to a bridal shower for my daughter-in-law, my future daughter-in-law. And when I got home, my husband asked me if I had talked with Alan, my son, who was living with us at the time. And I said, no, I haven't seen him yet. And he said, well, go in and say goodnight to him. So I went in to talk to Alan, and he said, has Dad talked to you? And I said, no. And he said, well, there's something that I need to tell you. And about this time, my husband came into the room, and Alan proceeded to explain something to me. And he said, you know, Mom, we really wanted to get married in the temple, but we couldn't go to the temple for a year after we got married. And I hope you won't be too disappointed. Well, my imagination was running wild. And he said, but we decided that since we had to wait a year before we could go to the temple, we would go ahead and elope. So they had eloped and gone to South Lake Tahoe and gotten married. So I said, well, if you're already married, why are we planning a wedding? And he said, well, Yvette's parents have always looked forward to her getting married, and she wants to have a marriage ceremony. And so we just decided we just go ahead and have the marriage ceremony and not say anything to anyone. At this point, I was thinking, I wish I didn't know this. So I said, well, why are you telling me then? And he said, well, Yvette's pregnant. So not only were our kids already married, we were going to be grandparents. And they assured us that the pregnancy happened after the ceremony. They wanted us to be sure that we knew that. And of course, we were, although we were somewhat surprised, we were also really very delighted and very excited that we were going to have a grandchild. So we, or they had a little card made up to go inside of the wedding invitations, which were already ordered and which said that they were going to get married in September. And the card announced that they had already gotten married, and or that the marriage had already taken place on June 9th. And so we went ahead, and the wedding turned out to be a ring ceremony, but it was done very much like a wedding. Yvette's father walked her down the aisle. I offered a prayer that was a kind of a ceremonial prayer. My husband talked about temple marriage and the importance of temple marriage. And then their bishop, instead of marrying them, talked to them about marriage. And they, Alan and Yvette, exchanged vows together. Not really exchanged vows, but they each spoke to each other and talked to the other one about their love for each other and promised that they would love each other forever. And it was really a very wonderful and warm ceremony. And certainly her parents felt like they had been able to fulfill this wish of seeing their daughter walk down the aisle and be married, even though it wasn't a marriage. And but she had her bridesmaids there and everything. It was a lovely ceremony. And of course, we all missed the wedding, not just her parents. Then on their first anniversary, 1 year later, they went to the temple and they were sealed. And on that day, her mother realized that this, her parents realized that this was a very special and important day for them. And I believe that she did go over to the temple. Didn't she go to the, yeah, she went over to the temple grounds and waited in the visitor center while they were sealed. And later in the day, we had a gathering at our house for family and friends so that they could all come and celebrate this day together also as their sealing day. And I think that also was a good experience for her parents, and they realized how important this was to them, even though they didn't share my son and daughter-in-law's religious views. Now, when my daughter got married on Valentine's Day of this year, actually, her husband had been a member of the church for quite a number of years. And his parents lived on the East Coast, so they didn't have close proximity to the kids. And they decided that they wanted to get married in the temple, but they also wanted to do something that would include his family. So they decided that they wanted to get married in the San Diego Temple, which was distant from our house in the Bay Area. So all of our family gathered down in San Diego, and they went to the temple and were sealed. That made having a reception on the day of their wedding impractical. And so they went on their honeymoon for a week and then came back and had their reception the following Saturday, 1 week later. And they had planned to have it outside. I guess there's a policy against having ring ceremonies in the chapel, but I hadn't read the handbook and I didn't know that. And so they had planned to have this in a park, but thanks to El Nino, we had a torrential rain that day, and so we wound up having the ring ceremony in the chapel, and a presiding church authority. I'll talk more about what he did, but first, the ceremony was kind of interesting. My other daughter and son, that my married son, play the trumpet. And since we weren't going to have an organ, my kids had planned to have trumpet music, and my daughter had selected the Mormon primary song, "Love is Spoken Here," as the music to use as they walked down the aisle. So they began by having my son play the male part. Mine is a home where every hour, I think you're probably familiar with it, and he played that part of the trumpet solo as my son-in-law's mother walked him into the chapel. And then as my husband walked my daughter in, my daughter played the female part. I see my mother kneeling with my family each day. And so they walked in together, and my son-in-law was very nervous about the ceremony, and so they decided that they did not want to exchange vows. And so instead they had the church official who presided talk to them about marriage. And at the conclusion, he pronounced a blessing on them. Oh, and when my son and daughter-in-law got married, their bishop also did that, and he actually had the families come and stand up in the circle, the extended families, the parents, brothers and sisters, and so we all stood around, and as he gave his priesthood blessing to the marriage, we were all standing around in the circle together, which was also a very nice thing. But when my daughter got married, the blessing was pronounced upon them, and then as they walked out together, my son and daughter played the two parts of Love Is Spoken Here together as they symbolically had joined in their union. I thought this was a wonderful way to include the families in something that really felt like a wedding, but they didn't exchange marriage vows as is sort of prescribed in this article in the Ensign. And I do agree that if they sort of go through a mock ceremony, that is kind of a mockery of what they've already done. But to exchange some kind of expressions of love to each other as they exchange rings, I think is a really very nice way to do it. And I know that the families of my children's mates really appreciated having this kind of a ceremony, and they have much warmer feelings about the church than they would have, I'm sure, if something hadn't been done to have some kind of a ceremonial a union that helped them feel like they were seeing the marriage of their son and daughter, respectively. And as we've talked about this, I just have one more suggestion that my husband came up with, actually. Another way to solve this problem would be to have an anteroom near the temple or adjacent to the temple where the bride and groom could get married and just have the marriage ceremony and the exchange of rings, and then they could immediately go into the ceiling and be sealed, and that way parents and brothers and sisters would be able to witness the wedding and not be excluded from this very important event. And I agree with what has been said already, that if we're really the family church, it seems very wrong to me to split up families at what should be one of the highlights of a young person's life, and certainly a time of celebration for the whole family, a time to bring everybody together. And then when we exclude the other parents, that doesn't seem like a very good way to show that we support the family.
I'm going to mess this up. I like the idea of the auntie room. They could call it the auntie and uncle room. Or maybe it could be the anti-room, I don't know. I want to give some historical, with a bit of theological information, to give us some background, some context for this discussion, and then I'll give a few personal experiences, so I hope I don't bore you with this little recitation of whirlwind tour through history. But first of all, you know, marriage, I want to talk about civil marriage and sacred or religious marriage, because they evolve down through history as two separate strands and two different lineages. And basically, marriage evolved in two spheres, the sacred sphere and the secular sphere. And in the secular sphere, marriage was a legal contract or a partnership, whereas in the sacred sphere of life, it was a religious sacrament or a rite. And the purpose of civil marriage, especially in pre-modern society, was a social contract for the purpose of acquiring property or securing property. And it mostly related to property. But other reasons for getting married were also relating to the sexual relationship, the birth of children, kinship, alliances, things like political alliances and things like that. So that was the purpose of civil marriage, whereas the purpose of sacred or religious marriage was to be one of several initiations or mystery rites in a mystical or religious tradition. And in fact, these religious rites were usually an acknowledgement of what already is in a person's life. So in most religious traditions, there are several steps or rites that people celebrate, such as birth or christening, baptism, some sort of, and especially in the Christian tradition, you have things like confirmation, Eucharist or the supper, penance, and then holy matrimony, which was one of those ceremonies. Sometimes it was referred to as sacred marriage, or the bridal chamber, or the bridal marriage. Other religious rites that we have are things like ordination, and there are rites that are given at death, things like that. So marriage is basically just one of these rites. And it's interesting if you look at, for example, the early Christian tradition, you have civil marriage, which is in the jurisdiction of the legal and social sphere, and then you have these mystery rites or religious rites that are separate. And in fact, in early Christianity, for the first 1,000 years, the marriage, the civil marriage, was not a religious rite. Civil marriages were performed by local authorities, and these marriage unions were not sanctified inside the church by a religious ceremony until about 900 AD. So between 900 AD and 1200 AD was when the Catholic Church began to more systematically offer a religious ceremony to honor a civil marriage that a couple might have. As an interesting side note, during that first 1,000 years, the marriage or union rite that was usually offered inside the churches was a ritual for priests. Priests would often have a commitment ceremony with each other. So actually gay marriage was legitimized by the church before heterosexual marriage was, which is very interesting. But so we have this shift in Christian tradition at this point. Between about 900 AD and 1200 AD, we see a coming together of the civil ceremony or the civil marriage and the religious rite or sacred rite of marriage. Then later, we have a real separation in the 1600s during the Protestant Reformation, because part of that Protestant Reformation was in that break, the Protestant break with Catholicism, that marriage was defined as a civil contract and was not a sacrament of the church. That was a really important aspect of the Protestant Reformation. And so Catholics continued to celebrate marriage as a religious rite and to combine those two ceremonies, whereas Protestants didn't. Protestants were married civilly by a legal authority, and then later, if they so chose, they might have a religious rite, but oftentimes did not. And it's interesting to note that the United States was settled by Protestants and is essentially a Protestant country. So if we think about that, we realize that Mormonism tends to be more Catholic in this way than Protestant. In fact, in Europe, for these last 400 years, that separation between church and state has stayed very strict. And in European countries, a couple is married civilly. That's the real marriage. That's the first one. And if they want to have a religious or a temple rite, that comes after. And so Mormons in many European and other Protestant countries, Mormons obey the laws of the land because it's law. I mean, it's such a strong Protestant tradition that this is law. So Mormons are married civilly first. And then they go to the temple to be sealed later. And there, in those situations, you know, the church observes the local laws, and there is not a year waiting period. You just simply go afterward. So I want to get to a little bit of history about the Mormon combination of these two rituals. It's interesting that in Christian history you have something similar to what you have in Mormon history, because in Christian history, for the first 1,000 years, the marriage, the civil ceremony, and the religious marriage are not the same. They're separate. And then later on, they become joined. The same thing is true in Mormonism. For the first 100 years of Mormonism, the two are separate. And it's only in this century that they really become joined. Basically, temple marriage or sealing is celestial marriage, which Joseph Smith instituted in 1843 as a result of his revelation on celestial marriage. And so sealing was just a way to unite a couple for eternity, but it also had the added dimension of being polygamous marriage. The sealing was basically celestial marriage, and celestial marriage is also eternal marriage, it's also patriarchal marriage, it's also polygamy. But I want to stick with just this discussion of civil versus temple marriage, because, of course, polygamous marriage is not necessarily civil or legal marriage. So I'll just talk about civil or legal marriage in the Mormon tradition versus temple marriage. But basically what you have happening is that the sealing ceremony is done by Joseph Smith, and eventually it's done in the Nauvoo Temple, and then later in Utah it's done in sealing or endowment houses until the temples are built. And so what you have in Mormon tradition is that couples would get married in the family home, and it was a civil ceremony, a very Protestant ceremony, and then afterward, when they could, they would have the sealing ceremony performed. And even after the temples began to be built and people were going to get their sealing in the temple, in the St. George and the Manti and then later the Salt Lake, they still were being married civilly first at home. Even the elite, the leaders and their kids. And in fact, until the turn of the century, you don't see a real strong push for those two to be united. People would have the marriage ceremony at home with all the family around, and then later they would go to the temple to be sealed. And the real marriage was at home with the family. That was the big ceremony. And then the sealing was very much in the tradition of a religious sacred rite, was a private sacred ritual. And I want to read just a few statements from Messages of the First Presidency to give you a feel for how that shifted at the turn of the century. So many things in Mormonism shifted at the turn of the century. I mean, you know, polygamy, women's authority, women's priesthood, relief society. I mean, so during this same period of time, we also see a shift in the policy on temple sealings. I'm just going to read a couple of these statements. At first, I also want to note that in the First Presidency statements, when they would refer to the temple and the purpose of the temple, they would specify that people would go to the house of the Lord for their endowments and sealings. They didn't say marriages at first. Here's one statement in 1855. Young people are counseled to obtain their endowments and to marry, and to seek their endowments in the house of the Lord. Young people are counseled to prepare to receive endowments and to receive sealings. It says, take unto yourselves, this is counsel for the young men. Young men, take unto yourselves wives of the daughters of Zion, and then come up and receive your endowments and sealings. So there's kind of a separation there. Of baptisms for the dead, of giving of endowments, and sealing. And then it also says once again, people should think of their baptisms, their endowments, and their sealings. And they're urged, members are urged to go to the temples. But later on, we find that about 1911, all of a sudden I find the first example of a statement where marriage is added. So now when the First Presidency talks about going to the temple for your sacred ordinances, here is what they say. And again, this is 1911. The temples are for the performance of sacred ordinances for the living and the dead. The principal ceremonies are baptisms, endowments, marriages, sealings, and adoptions. Which is interesting, so it changes and all of a sudden marriages. Here's another interesting thing that is said about marriage. And this is 1911. The Latter-day Saints marry for time and eternity, not merely until death parts husband and wife. Marriages performed under the civic law and by ministers of other denominations are regarded as honorable and effectual so far as it relates to this life. But in order to be effectual in the life to come, such covenants must be made for eternity and such unions must be formed according to God's law under His authority. So there's encouragement for those who have been married civilly to go ahead to the temple. Finally, in 1918, we see Joseph F. Smith, one of my favorite prophets, who was the same man who wrenched authority away from Emmeline Wells and also instituted the priesthood correlation program in 1914. Joseph F. Smith and other members of the First Presidency suddenly make an elaborate definition of temple policy. And this is 1918 in temple instructions to the bishops. And they talk about garments and they even talk about how people coming to the temple are expected to make donations. But here in this statement, this very definitive statement about temple policy, it says, it should be clearly made known to those who can receive recommends to be married in the temple that they should not have the marriage ceremony performed before coming to the temple, unless there is some good and justifiable reason for doing so, such as having to delay an undesirable length of time before they could come, or having to travel alone by team to reach the temple. So, and it's signed Joseph F. Smith. So that's the first example I find of a real definitive statement. I guess my point in this is that I don't know that it was the right thing to do to merge civil marriage with temple marriage. I think that that violates separation of church and state. I think it's not respectful of the difference between those two ceremonies, one being of a very different nature than the other. I think that it's far more respectful to maintain the separation between these two rituals and allow each to have its place. And so what I would like to see is a return to the allowance of families to have the big family wedding at home and then couples to retire to the temple with those personal friends and relatives who they desire to have in attendance and have the sacred ceremony as a separate and holy religious rite. I don't think it would be hard to do that, and I think it would be more in keeping with our own tradition and with Protestant tradition and with the tradition of our country. Along with this, I want to just talk briefly about the situation in my own family. Temple marriage versus civil marriage has been a divisive issue. And it's interesting because my own parents were not married in the temple. They were married civilly first, and it was in the 1940s. Which, again, it's interesting because even though this policy statement was made in 1918, for a few decades afterwards, people still continued to get married civilly first. I mean, it wasn't until the 1940s that actually couples were being chastised for getting married civilly first. And there are numerous anecdotal examples of people who would come to Salt Lake to get married, and the general authorities would chastise them for having gotten married civilly first. So it took a while for the policy to really sink in, but by the 1940s and then 50s, you see people starting to adhere to the policy more. But in the 1940s, when my parents got married and many other people got married, it was still very accepted tradition to get married civilly first at a home wedding, as my parents were married at my grandmother's home with friends and family, and then my dad immediately went off to war the next day and was drafted, the following day, and then came back later, a year or two later, and they were sealed as a private ceremony. So even though that was the pattern for my parents, there's been so much pressure, you know, in our day and age for temple marriage that it has become a divisive issue in my family. There are four of us, and my two older sisters were married civilly. They did not marry members of the church, and I have remained single by choice. And so my younger sister is the only one of us to get married in the temple. So when it came time for her to get married in the temple, there was this dilemma because some of us couldn't attend and others could. And it was interesting because what happened was my sister from Seattle came with all of her children, and she had sewn the dresses, the bridesmaids' dresses, and had worked for weeks to prepare for this wedding, flew all the way down here and didn't realize she wasn't going to be able to participate at all. And so they stood outside the Salt Lake Temple while everybody went inside and went to the wedding, those who could, and some people waited outside. And so my sister and her daughters and other members of the family couldn't go in. I couldn't go in. Afterwards, when my sister got ready to leave and go back to Seattle, she told her two daughters, "If you ever get married, don't do it like this. Promise me you will not do it like this." And I think she felt very cheated that she'd worked so hard to help prepare for this wedding and then couldn't participate at all. This problem has extended and continued with members of the family, my nieces and nephews. And whenever a niece or nephew gets married, the whole issue comes up again. Who gets to go and who doesn't? And what's happened is that a couple of my sisters and my mother have used the occasion of temple marriage as a way to coerce other members of the family into activity by shaming and laying guilt trips on those who can't go. There's a lot of negative judgment that is passed and things that are said, and tremendous pressure is applied for people to get active or get their temple recommend so they can go. And this has only made some of us rebel even more. And so we've kind of formed this split in my family where whenever there's a wedding, if it's a temple wedding, then some of us get together and have our own private little party, you know, as the heathens, you know, who can't go. And then later we all go to the reception. But I think that what happens is that temple marriage, being both civil ceremony and religious rite, has divided families rather than joined families. And I think the solution is to separate the civil and the religious rite, because I think it's very paradoxical. I think that basically by joining the marriage rite and the civil rite, families are divided. But by separating the civil and the religious rite, families can be rejoined.
Maxine and I have been thinking very much along the same lines. I've had strong feelings about temple marriage ever since my own temple marriage over 30 years ago. When I was 20, I was a Mormon princess, and I'd never seen anything but Mormon weddings, although I should qualify that and say all I had ever seen was Mormon receptions, because nobody, to my knowledge, had ever seen an actual wedding, marriage. When I got married, Harold B. Lee sealed us, and I don't remember a word he said. I hadn't slept well the night before. I was dealing with the dress. I was tired at the reception, and it wasn't until I got in there and really realized that my father wasn't there, who has been so dear to me, and none of my brothers and sisters, because they were all younger than me. And I looked around and I thought, what kind of a deal is this? All of the years that they had taught us, they never told us that when we got to be married, that the people we loved wouldn't be there. It never hit me until that moment, and it's bothered me ever since. I have no problem at all with sealings. I agree with a lot of what Elder Coford is saying. I think sealings celebrate a deep-seated wish that loving relationships of this life be made permanent and lasting. The problem I see occurs when sealings and weddings are combined into one occasion, because as Maxine says, they're two very different kinds of occasions, and when you force them together, you do damage both to the wedding part of the process and to the sealing part of the process. A wedding is a traditional public family-oriented event. Everybody's there, even down to the little kids. It usually involves food and music and gifts. A sealing, on the other hand, is a private religious experience with a minimum of social implications. It's a time of introspection and emanation and spiritual commitment, and it should be approached with as few outside distractions as possible. When you turn weddings into sealings, we immediately have problems because we exclude through the recommend process many people who are closest and dearest to the couple. We are assessing worthiness at a time when worthiness should not be an issue. A wedding is really the wrong time to be judging people's souls. Not only are we judging many to be unworthy of attending a major family event, we're also excluding those who are younger than temple age. I know of no other religion on the face of the earth that bars family members, including parents, from witnessing the marriage of a child. No amount of understanding or walking around loving gardens or hand-holding in waiting rooms or meetings afterwards is going to erase the bitterness that many people harbor for years at the self-righteous exclusion of our church of those without temple recommends from the weddings of their children. Now, the problem is most serious here in Utah, and it's only going to be getting worse as the church expands, and even most Mormon families are more a mixture of those who are temple-worthy and those who are not. For a church that's building its reputation on the support of the family, this policy is highly counterproductive to family well-being, and I wonder if Elder Cofort is living on the same planet as the rest of us when he says he has never seen anyone offended by this policy if it's explained correctly. Now, that you've got to realize the problem works the other way, too. When we try to make sealings into weddings, then the sealings suffer. Ironically, Elder Cofort's article lists every single reason why sealings are impaired because they are also weddings. There's a limit on how many guests a temple can really handle. Sometimes these weddings, you know, there are too many people, and the temple doesn't want that many people. That's a problem. There you have the difficulty of adapting wedding dresses so that they can be taken into the temple. There are issues of lack of concentration due to fatigue. I am a living witness of that. The difficulty of keeping a sealing a sacred experience due to the social activities, which usually have to fall pretty close to the same day. People travel. They're there. You know, you can't just stretch this out. He records every last one of them. And it's just too much to do at once and preserve the true value and sanctity of a sealing. When Elder Cofort advises couples to move as much of the social part of the marriage off the day of the sealing, he should reflect that a change in the church's policies to eliminate the one-year period would remove all of the social part of the wedding from the day of the sealing. The current church policy of insisting that weddings and sealings be one event partakes of what is called the double handful of fertilizer theory. This theory states that if one handful of fertilizer is good, two handfuls of fertilizer is even better. In other words, if it's a good idea to encourage temple weddings, temple sealings, it's an even better idea to mandate temple sealings, or at least strongly discourage anything else. The problem is that the plants, in this case both weddings and sealings, wither and die under this heavy-handed approach. Neither one is fully satisfied. Neither one does well. Now, as I've talked to people, you know, the obvious solution here is to get rid of the one-year waiting period. Allow people to split them up. Allow each function to take its natural course. Here are the objections that people give to me. Objection one. The church is in the business of promoting temple sealings. Any policy which does this is justified, even at the cost of family unity. My response, any policy that achieves its objectives through coercion and unnecessary unkindness should never be part of the Church of Christ. Objection 2, without this policy, the number of temple sealings will decline. My response, if the sealing statistics go down, it's only because people are no longer being coerced into a temple marriage. Anyone who should be sealed in the temple will see that they are sealed in the temple. The sealing ordinance is sufficiently attractive to stand on its own. Christ is not pleased with involuntary compliance. This is too important a step to be taken because of social pressure. Objection 3. People who marry outside the temple just want a big fancy wedding. My response is, so what? There are good and valid reasons, which this panel is discussing in detail, for marrying outside of the temple. So if it's a big fancy wedding, who cares? There are big fancy receptions that follow temple ceilings and nobody objects. The size of the wedding is a family decision, not something to be dictated by the church. Objection 4. The temple marriage is a valid test of religious conviction, and the church is justified in using it. After all, didn't Christ say, "He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy than me of me"? My response. Christ meant this statement in the larger sense of choosing a whole new Christian life, which may put one in conflict with one's family upbringing. The temple marriage test is not a valid test of religious conviction because, one, it's an unnecessary test, and two, it's not reliable. People have good reasons for choosing to marry outside the temple that have little to do with their testimony. Besides, a wedding is a terrible time for loyalty tests. Life in general takes care of that sort of thing. So I would like to propose that the church eliminate the one-year waiting period in the United States, that they open their chapels graciously for family weddings and encourage people to get sealed in the temple as soon as they're ready and able. This would allow weddings and sealings to be separate events and would eliminate the exclusion of close families from weddings as well as protecting the sanctity of the sealing. Of course, there are plenty of couples who, if this were made an option, would still choose to be married in the temple, and that won't change for a lot of people. It'll stay the same. But for a significant minority, this would ease a lot of family bitterness and heartache. If the church is as concerned about its image as it seems to be under President Hinckley, this policy change would only help.
Well, now we have a lot of questions to consider, and I think I would like to go through with the panel these objections that Vicki has just gone through. Maybe you could read them for us, Vicki, and we can discuss them as a group. And along with that, I would like to discuss the different alternatives. As I've been listening, I've heard several different suggestions. And so I want us to discuss as a panel for the next, 6 or 7 minutes, maybe 10, the alternatives, the pros and cons, what are the strengths and weaknesses of each. And then I want to open it up because we want to have time for you to join in on this discussion. I think I've basically seen, three different possibilities. Maybe one has two versions to it. One is the idea that Nadine proposed, the idea that you have some kind of an anteroom to the temple where you have a ceremony before going into the sealing. The second one is the notion of what we've been doing now, where you have some kind of a ceremony after that tries to include the larger family. The third is the idea of separating the marriage and the sealing. Now, Maxine, you talked about that more as a separation between the civil and the sacred. I don't know if I like that terminology. In fact, I think it's interesting in the history of marriage and in Christianity and the Western world that even though it's true that Protestantism has never considered marriage a sacrament like Mormons do or like Catholics do, that I don't know enough about the history to know how at first Protestants did this, but I know quite quickly there developed a policy of having marriages in the churches, the Protestant churches, because I think people see it as a sacred thing. That yes, there's the civil aspect of it, but I think for most people, if they're religious, they would see the marriage as having a sacred component to it. And I think that this would be a real question with Mormon marriages, if we did separate them, does that mean that there's something still sacred about the marriage before? How do we deal with this problem? Vicki suggested the same thing, that we separate the marriage and the sealing, but I think you were more concentrating on the idea of just eliminating the waiting period. So maybe we can, I'll start with you, Maxine, since I just criticized your idea of separating the civil and the sacred.
Okay. Yeah, I'm happy to respond to that. The reason why I would like to see that is because I'm someone who really appreciates and loves sacred ritual, and I would like to see that not watered down or confused with civil or social or legal arrangements. I like the separation between the two, because even though marriage is a religious right, that's a coincidence that marriage is also a social contract. So there are two kinds of marriage. And I respect people's religious rituals. I respect my Catholic friends, my Mormon friends and family, and my Buddhist friends and my pagan friends. And, you know, I consider myself a Gnostic, and I've been undergoing Gnostic initiation for the last year. I want people to respect my religious rites as much as I respect theirs. They're very sacred to me. And if you combine any Buddhist or Gnostic or pagan religious rite with the legal social ordinance of the state, I think that's a confusion of church and state. And I think what happens is that whatever religion is dominant in that area begins to enforce or assert its religious rights into the secular sphere of the people living in that area. And so I feel firmly that these things should be kept separate.
Vicky, do you want to...
Well, there's always, as far as solutions are concerned, there's always one solution that's always been available to everybody, and that's just don't get married in the temple. And looking back on it, that's what I wish I had done. It never even occurred to me at that time. You know, if I had done that, what would have happened? Well, the ward would have been abuzz with rumors of that I was pregnant. That's probably what would have happened. And, you know, I wasn't willing to endure that in those days. I'm not even sure if I was 20 years old if I could have endured that now. But one solution has always been there. Don't get married in the temple. Get married civilly. Wait the year. Show them that you're not pregnant or not care and get pregnant. And then go get sealed in the temple when you're fasting and you're praying and you're in the mood to do it and you can concentrate on what's happening. I wish that's what I would do. Now, other countries, we've already noticed, you know, this is not a problem. It's against the law. They do not recognize a temple sealing as a wedding. Can't be done. The church has relaxed the policies. This is not an issue in a lot of countries. The only issue that has been a little crazy, but I think they've relaxed it. For a while, I believe there was some kind of rule that if you got married civilly in, you know, say in South Africa and there wasn't a temple there at that time, you had to fly to the London temple, that you couldn't consummate the marriage till you got sealed, which led to a lot of very stressful scrambling. I don't think that's in policy, that's in force anymore. I think it's fine to consummate the marriage, and a lot of people attend the temple for their sealing as part of their honeymoon, which sounds to me like a lovely way to do it. Another possible, now the most aggressive way to attack this would be to go after the state law and get every state to agree not to recognize a temple sealing as a wedding, a valid wedding, because of its exclusionary policies. Now, that would be a long, hard fight. That would be in every state in which there was a temple. You'd have to fight that one out. You'd probably have problem of religion. And I don't know if you could even really make it stick, since the church does allow you to be married civilly. The pressure here is not that you can't be married civilly. It's just that society, there's just a lot of pressure to do it this way, and it causes a lot of family problems. I just don't see why we don't just let the policy go and make everybody happy. And I think a lot of people, most people will still get sealed in the temple. It's a lovely thing to do. Who wouldn't want to?
I have just a couple of comments. First one is, in Maxine, in your recitation of the history of getting married civilly, one thing you didn't mention that I think you could have was that the old prologue to the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants used to say that people were supposed to get married in a public ceremony. Are you aware of that? Yeah. It's the one that starts out. That it's not in the Doctrine and Covenants, but it used to start out by saying something about the Church of Christ having been reproached for fornication. We now declare that a man should have one wife and a woman, but one husband. I'm sure you're familiar with that language. And it goes on to say that marriage are supposed to be performed in a public ceremony. So that might be something that you want to add to your history if you're putting something together. The second thing that I wanted to comment about is that the church is really somewhat hostile to having weddings at all in the chapels. I recently had a relative, he's a distant relative, I don't even know him, but my mother just went to a wedding of her sister's grandson, and he was marrying somebody who was not LDS. And so they had to choose a church to get married in, and they wanted the bishop to marry them, and the bishop did marry them, but he did it in her church, because that was where they could have a nice church wedding, and they couldn't do it in the LDS church. And I really wonder if this also doesn't send a wrong message. I think maybe the reason, or part of the reason for it, is because of a feeling that we don't want fancy weddings competing with temple marriage, and that if people can get married in a fancy wedding in the chapel, that they might not want to get married in the temple in a simple ceremony where only close relatives can be there. But I really don't think that it would discourage sealing, because, as Vicky just said, a sealing is a wonderful thing to do. And certainly for young people who are in love with each other, they want this marriage to go on forever. And I just don't see any decrease in the amount of sealings that would take place if the two ceremonies could be separated and we eliminated the one-year waiting period.
I can see really no purpose to the one-year waiting period except to punish people. Mm-hmm. You know, with new converts, I can see a year. You want to make sure you want to do this. But if both people are temple worthy and they get a civil sealing and then they have to wait a year, the only purpose is to punish them.
Well, and I personally, I will enter in, even though I'm supposed to be the moderator, right? I personally feel that one of the most negative things that happens through all of this is the judgment. And the separation of people on the basis of a judgment of other people's worthiness and righteousness. I mean, I was listening to the language that you used. There was the idea that the way they put it is that if you can't enter the temple, you're an unclean thing. Do we really want to say that about people, either members or non-members?
Or your mom and dad.
That you're calling them an unclean thing. I think it's... I can understand maybe one of the reasons... I mean, we could discuss this. I don't know that we have time. But, you know, why are the reasons that the church is trying to enforce this so strongly? And we could be either cynical or kind in our evaluation of this. Certainly it puts a lot of people, pressure on a lot of people to have temple recommends, to pay their tithing, to be active in the church. It gives a lot of incentive when there are these kinds of stakes. On the other hand, do we really know the state of people's souls? In the last few years, as I have not had a temple recommend for quite some time, for reasons that unfortunately have been too public, I have had the experience of standing outside the temple when my nieces and nephews have been married, and there is a lot of judgment that goes on. In my family, it's not the sort of pressure, it's more the feeling of, you poor thing, it's too bad you're going to hell, we feel so sorry for you. Can't you please repent and be like the rest of us? It creates a horrible division in the family and a sense of who is good and who is bad. And I really worry about that. To me, this judgment, this self-righteousness, is one of the worst aspects of it. Now, I think as a panel, we kind of all like the idea of separating marriages and sealings. I go along with the rest of you, even though I'm a little uncomfortable about some of the civil sacred thing. But I think a separation of the marriage and the sealing, as Vicky put it, would help both of those tremendously. So we've kind of made a decision as the panel. I'd like to now open it up to you as an audience. Tell us your stories. Tell us your opinions. What would you like to say? Maybe we should have you come up here. Just kind of form a line because, you know, we want to get this on tape. Okay. Who? A rush up here. We have 15 minutes. It's testimony meeting.
Well, I think something that people haven't really mentioned either is the fact that, especially with church culture now the way it is, that women don't tend to even get their endowments until they go to the temple to get married. And so it makes it sort of an awkward situation. I mean, I had the same thing when I got married a couple of months ago where, I mean, who knows if you're really ready to go to the temple or not, or whether you even want to at this point. But, I mean, since it's just like you're getting married in the temple, you got to get your endowments, you got to do it all. And if you could separate the two, it seems like it would just be more meaningful for women, especially the way the church is right now.
With you as a lawyer on the panel, I'm curious if the church runs a risk of somebody in a more sympathetic state, say Massachusetts, of very determined parents legally challenging the state giving a license. I've been told that in London that the church can get licenses, but they can't use them in the temple. I'm not sure if that's correct. But I also wonder, kind of as a second question, what if a couple in the family, of course this brings up the problem of money, what if they chose to fly to London and get married to avoid this? But I am curious, what do you have anything to say about what would happen if a parent decided to legally challenge this?
I think that in the United States, a legal challenge wouldn't have a prayer. I am quite up to date on the law surrounding church and state. And in the United States, the courts are really very deferential to churches and will not interfere with their ceremonies. And you know, I practice law in California, where anybody who is self-defined as a minister practically can perform a marriage. I mean, if you go on the internet and you put your name and address onto the Universal Life Church website and print out a certificate that makes you a minister, you can perform a marriage in California. and they just don't look at who any other criteria. So I think that a legal challenge would not succeed. And my personal feeling is that I really want the government to keep out of religion and religion to keep out of government. And I like that wall of separation and separation of church and state. And I wouldn't want the government overlooking anybody's marriage ceremonies.
Well, I know that the thing that I had a problem with was that their objection to having the big wedding. And, you know, as a little girl, always dream of having a big wedding with a wedding dress and the limousines and the stuff like that. And then you grow up and you realize you can't have any of that because if you're going to be worthy, you have to get married in the temple and you have to have a very bland and boring wedding. And I think that you go to, like, Mormon receptions and they're just boring, and I think that's wrong.
I'd like to make one comment on that. I had there was a little girl in my ward when the Bountiful Temple had their open house. She was this devout little child, and she wanted to go to the open house. She was about 17, and so she came with our family because her parents are non-members. And she walked in, and we were touring through the temple. We got into the main endowment room, and she looked around, and she said, "Are this many people going to be here for my wedding?" You know, I think we stress this so strongly. I'm not sure our girls realize anything else goes on in these temples except weddings. And she had just no clue as to what it was going to be like. Nor did I.
I'm going to tell you my story. I have two children that were going to be married. They had announced their engagements. And so I had been planning to ask my husband for a divorce. So I decided, well, I'll wait till after they're married. and then I will ask him for a divorce. So I went to my bishop to get a recommend. And I told him we had been having some problems, and he asked if he could give me a blessing. So I said, yes, I would like that very much. When he gave me the blessing, I just cried. I cried all the way home. I thought, no, I cannot hold this inside myself until after they're married. I'm going to ask for the divorce now. So I did, and the bishop then called me and said if I had gone to see the stake president. I said, no. He says, well, don't go see him till you talk to me. So I go back in, and he wants my recommend back. And he said, you didn't tell me you were going to ask for a divorce. Well, I said, I had no plans to, but I couldn't hold that in any longer. And I said, I don't have my recommend, but I'm going to see the stake president, and I will give it to him if he doesn't feel that I can have a recommend. And when I went to see the stake president, he talked for me for a short time, and said he would get back with me because he had something pressing. So my son eloped and went to Las Vegas, and then I saw the stake president, and he finally decided to give me my recommend. But my daughter's wedding was canceled because the boy she was going to marry his parents felt that they were uncomfortable about him marrying someone whose parents were going through a divorce. But it was quite an experience for me to learn that this thing could become a punitive thing. To me, it was punitive. I was being punished for asking for a divorce and would have been deprived of seeing my daughter married. And this does concern me very much because I would not have I would never have known how another person would feel in this situation if I had not gone through that. So I do have some concerns, very serious concerns now, and would very much like to see it separated.
I understand, if I'm wrong, somebody correct me, that it is the policy of the church now that when couples go through a divorce that they have to surrender their temple recommends. I guess this is a whole other topic of discussion. I know I had a friend who, her husband ran off with another woman, and so they went into a divorce, and when they took away her recommend, it only added to all the pain that she already had. Anyway, there's my feeling on it.
I don't know that that's a policy. I got divorced and didn't have to give it up.
Is it or not? Any?
Well,